Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee has proposed a budget for the new fiscal year, which starts on July 1st. At $9.6 billion, it's equal to that of the entire state of Arizona, $2 billion more than the annual budget of Afghanistan, and we're spending almost $1 billion more than we did 2 years ago. And to look at it yet another way, it's almost double what San Francisco budgeted in 2005, although the population has increased by only 10% since then. So will this new budget effectively address problems like potholes in the streets, the uptick in property crime and homelessness? Does our budget present a unique opportunity to engage in innovative governance? And finally, what's San Francisco's return on investment when it comes to its annual budget? To discuss this and more, I'm pleased to be joined in the studio by Joe Eskenazi. He's senior editor of politics and government for San Francisco Magazine and editor of San Francisco Magazine's March 2016 feature, The City Report Card. Welcome, Joe.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show.
And by phone, we're joined by Lisa Feldstein. She's professor on the faculty at the Master of Public Affairs program for the University of San Francisco. She has served in the San Francisco Mayor's Office of Housing under two administrations. She's also served as a San Francisco Planning Commissioner. Her research focuses on urban politics and land use, urban planning and policy, social equity, and resources in low-income communities. Welcome, Lisa.
Thanks. I'm really pleased to be here.
And later in the hour, we'll be joined by San Francisco Supervisor Mark Farrell. Supervisor Farrell represents District 2 and for the past 4 years has chaired the Board of Supervisors Budget and Finance Committee, the body that works with the budget proposal that the mayor has put forth. But before that, we invite you, our listeners, to join in with questions and comments. Think about them now. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes. And that number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you've got some questions or thoughts now, you can email them to us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. So, Lisa Feldstein at the University of San Francisco, I wanted to start with an overview of the budget proposal. Just give us some highlights. What is in that $9.6 billion?
Well, there's a lot in that $9.6 billion. Some of the things that the mayor has highlighted particularly are more attention to neighborhoods that are victims of high rates of violence, looking at the problems of homelessness a little bit differently by creating a combining all of the homeless services in one department and adding some additional funding to that program. But in addition, it's all of the stuff that we take for granted as part of a city, things like our streets and sidewalks and the libraries, just the cost of running government every year. All of that is in there, our police, just anything you can think about when you walk out of your door in the morning, anything that you interact with is in this budget.
And how is it apportioned? Tell us a little bit more, if you could break down the percentages of how the money is spent.
Well, it's spent, a lot of it goes into public protection, and that falls on, you know, that's both police and fire, things like that. Public works, transportation, and commerce is another big chunk of it. There's human welfare. There's community health, culture and recreation. And then there's the general cost of running the city, administration, and finance. So the way that we interact with those things are police and fire, the streets. Human welfare is our public health system and our human services. Community health is also part of that. The public health department. Culture and recreation includes our parks and recreation system. And general administration and finance is the cost of running the city, what it actually costs to pay all of the people who make sure the city keeps going.
So as I mentioned in my introduction, the size of the budget has increased substantially in the last number of years. Why is that? Why is our budget so big?
Well, we are unusual in a lot of ways. And San Francisco has a wealthy population, relatively speaking. Of course, we have poverty, but overall we have an income that is higher than the average income in many places in the country. We also have a really, really thriving economy and lots of business that's doing well. And what that does is it allows us to generate a lot more in tax income. We've also made a commitment to services for the public that not all cities have. So, for example, we work very, very hard to provide services to our homeless population and to our low-income populations and to try to project forward what our needs are going to be in the future. We also have money that has been specifically earmarked for certain uses. So the voters most recently decided that they wanted a baseline of funding for parks. But we've done the same thing with children's services and with libraries. So there are levels of funding below which we cannot go by laws we've imposed upon ourselves.
The voters have imposed upon themselves.
Yes.
Yes. And what percentage of the budget is sort of set aside or earmarked, for lack of a better term?
Well, to understand that, it helps to understand that about half of the revenue that the city receives is money that comes in already limited in what we can do with it. So money that comes from the state for mortgage relief, for example, or money that comes from the federal government to reimburse the public health department for Medicare, things like that. That's about half of the revenue, and those dollars are not fungible, meaning that we can't take them and spend them on something else. We can only spend them on the things we were given them to spend on. Then you've got 50% of the budget, which is general fund money, and that's money that we get from things like property taxes and sales taxes and the hotel tax. And that 50% would theoretically be all money that we could rearrange to cover whatever expenses were most pressing in the moment. But of that, about 40% of that money, or 20% of the budget overall, is earmarked by the voters, is restricted in how it can be spent. So it's only 30% of the whole budget that can then be looked at as opportunity money to do other things with. So to meet new emerging needs that we might not have had problems with in the past. So, for example, perhaps we need to give more money to the public health department to address Zika. That's not something we ever had to do before. So there are things that come up, but there are also things that have to keep being paid for, and all of those things have to come out of that 30%.
And we'll dig a little deeper into what those things are. But before I turn to Joe Eskenazi, I wanted to ask you, is there a way that people who study budgeting and finance at the government level, whether it be local or state or federal, are there principles by which we sort of judge a budget as good or not good, a good use of money or not, or is it just really too politicized to even go there? Because I'm curious if you have a sense of how do you make sense of how the money is allocated, and particularly the growth in how much is being budgeted.
Well, I think some of that it is definitely politics, but I like to think of it a little bit differently. I think that the attempt by our mayor and our board of supervisors, who are also involved in this process, is to come up with a budget that really does reflect the values of the city, what we think is important. And so if we as a city named after St. Francis believe that paying more money to try to help the poor and less fortunate and homeless, those people with the greatest need, if that's a value that we hold, then more of our budget is going to be assigned to pay for those kinds of expenses than in a city where that's less important to the public. So I would say that this budget is really a reflection of both the city's needs but also its values, which I think is a little bit different from saying that it's political. I think that it's largely value driven, and individuals can disagree as to whether it's an accurate reflection of our values as a city. But I think that that's what we see in it. And in terms of the growth, I would say that you can look at this budget and say San Francisco has done a very impressive job with the booming economy and in our ability to attract funds from other sources like the federal government and the state government. We've done a really outstanding job of bringing revenue into the city. And so we are spending that revenue on things that we find important that are consistent with our values.
So spend the money that we're getting.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so I'm going to have you hold there, and I'm going to turn next to Joe Eskenazi, Senior Editor of Politics and Government for San Francisco Magazine and editor of the magazine's March 2016 feature, The City Report Card. And one of the articles in that it gives this the budget, the city's budget, a grade of D. So Joe Eskenazi, explain how you and your colleagues at San Francisco Magazine came up with that assessment.
Well, the article is written by my longtime colleague Benjamin Wax, and I don't know that the category was budget, but it might have been spending. Now, first of all, the professor is exactly right. Our vastly expanded budget also represents good times. We are making a lot more money. Our enterprise agencies, such as the airport and the port, are bringing in money. And that money is being spent. However, if you look at the general fund has just about exactly doubled in the last 10 years, from $2.44 billion to $4.9 billion. So we are spending twice as much. Now, what was brought up heavily in the article that Benjamin wrote is that a great deal of what we're spending on the employees that we already had. We have just about doubled the expenditures on our workforce, despite the fact that we've added about 3,000 people in the last 10 years. So it goes from, you know, that's about 10%. So we're spending twice as much, though we've only had a 10% addition. Why is that? Because of pension costs and because of healthcare costs. That's not to give the boot to the workforce, but it's because of the realities that pension costs and healthcare costs are going up. And this city was irresponsible in the last boom times and did not put away money for the pension costs because it was thought that this was going to go up and up and up and up, and it did not. So especially in 2008, billions of dollars evaporated from the pension fund, and those have to be remade remunerated by dollars out of the city's general fund, more or less. And that's something that we are now budgeting for. The city's much more responsible than it was in the past, but that means you have to pay for these things.
So are you saying there that the increase in the budget is kind of it because it's a fallout of previous budgets that didn't really make sure that that these mandates were funded?
In large part. I mean, a lot of the things the professor mentioned are all true. We do value services to the homeless. We do offer, you know, I think that there is a good faith effort, and I think a lot of money is being put towards it. But $241 million is only a small percentage of what is of this budget. San Francisco has an exceedingly high budget because of one reason that always comes up, is that it's a city and a county. This is true. If you think of Oakland, Oakland is in Alameda County. Alameda County pays for some things such as the Alameda County DA. They have jails. They have those sorts of things. It is not the city of Oakland that's paying for the airport. In San Francisco, we are a combined city and county, so we pay for everything. But we pay more per capita than any other city, county in the entire country. Lots more. We run our own municipal transportation agency. We run an airport. We run two hospitals. We run a lot of – we have a water system. You know, it is – we choose to run these things. Now, very few people would say don't run the hospital, don't run the airport, don't run Muni. But that is one of the reasons that our budget is so much higher than other cities, other city counties. Because, you know, at $850,000, we're still not a particularly large city.
So is this a problem in your mind?
No, it's not a problem, but it is something to keep in mind. It is something to keep in mind that I do think that this budget does reflect the values of the city, but I can't say that isn't political. It's when people find that there's that it's not connected, then things become political. I don't think people are revolting because it doesn't really affect them. It just, you know, this number is too large to conceive of, as would be a smaller number. It's just a very large budget. And I don't think it's a problem, but I think that we must acknowledge it's a very high budget, but we must also acknowledge that we are choosing to do a lot with this money.
But it sounds like when you say a lot, there's actually very little of that allot that actually goes to doing other things as opposed to financing retirees and current employees and servicing our debt. So are we actually doing a lot, or are we just saddled with a lot of debt and IOUs?
The answer to that question is yes. We are doing all of these things. San Francisco is very ambitious in what it does, but also we are paying for generosity and for ambitiousness of the past. We voted, and by the way, in San Francisco, we're a charter city. We vote for almost all of this. So, you know, if you don't like the fact that so much money is apportioned to retirees and retirees' health care and the health care of retirees' spouses, which we voted for, remember that your forebears or perhaps even you voted for it. So to extend lifetime health care to the spouses of workers who worked for 5 years or more to the San Francisco city employees, that's something we voted on. And we did that, and that will cost billions of dollars. So we also voted to not be as generous in the future when these costs started adding up. So almost everything that we are doing is something that was dangled before the voters at some point in time.
So, Lisa, what do you make of this argument that so much of our budget is sort of taken up by our needs to meet obligations that were voted on by the voters? Is there something that we should be looking here about budgeting by the ballot box that is something to be questioning?
Well, there's no question that we budget by ballot box, and I would say that, you know, it's absolutely the case that we are paying for poor investment decisions around our retirement plan, money that was promised to city workers for decades. So those things are real. And when the voters vote for a bond, what that's saying is we'd like you to borrow money to do something. And those bonds do have to be repaid. So we are always in the process of repaying money that we borrowed to do something that we didn't have the cash on hand to do. It's very much as though, you know, someone used a credit card or took out a home equity loan. So we do spend a lot of money on obligations that were incurred previously. There's no question about that. But sometimes that's necessary. The city can't really keep unlimited amounts of cash on hand in the event that something goes wrong. And so when the voters voted in the early 2000s on the $4 billion water bond, the city couldn't defer that work until they could set aside $4 billion out of, you know, on current revenue to do that work. That work needed to be done, or we risked not having water at all in the event of a large earthquake. So the work had to be done, and it had to be paid for. And there's a lot that's like that. I do think that the budget is so complicated and so enormous. I mean, it's, 450 pages long. There's so much in there that it's difficult for most people to commit the amount of time that would be necessary to really understand it. And so voters often are voting for things because they sound like really good ideas, and they may be really good ideas. But those ideas are being plucked out and held up individually and not looked at in the context of the overall budget. So when we decided that we wanted libraries to be open certain numbers of hours and to set that back to a time before when libraries had been open more, when we decided that we needed to increase library hours and that we were going to ensure that we had the money to do that, that was a decision that was a good decision for our access to libraries, but wasn't looked at in the context of the overall city budget. And I don't think it's realistic for the voters to look at things like that in the context of the overall budget. It's just too much information.
I think that that's true. I think that the Hetch Hetchy bonds is a very good example, but it's also a good example of something that's not unique to this city, which is kicking the can down the road to another administration. The $4 billion in bonds were necessary because it was determined by a great series of investigative reports at the time by the Chronicle that the city had been siphoning out of the maintenance fund for the Hetch Hetchy system to just keep the city running, and therefore that's why the $4 billion was necessary in bonds, and they've gone a billion over that and counting. This city has gotten a little bit out of hand with going into bonded debt. We passed a $248 billion bond to pave the roads. That seems to be an incredibly unwise use of bonded debt to me, to be spending money on infrastructure improvements that will be obsolete before the bonds come due. And what's more, I think something that should be pointed out is this $9.6 billion budget that's in front of us is an unbalanced budget. This is $9.6 billion, but it is not balanced. It still is determinant upon us passing 75 hundredths of a cent sales taxes come November for the Municipal Transportation Agency and for homeless services, which we probably will. But still, $9.6 billion is dependent upon us voting, you know, a set-aside tax upon ourselves. So that's again, not to say, you know, not to be Scrooge McDuck and not to be the token Republican who writes opposition into the voter guide in pen, all capital, but, you know, it's pretty amazing that a $9.6 billion budget for a city of 850,000 is unbalanced and is dependent upon us taxing ourselves additionally.
Well, I think that there's something to that, but I also think that if you look at something like the streets, we have, you know, oh gosh, hundreds of millions of dollars in deferred maintenance in San Francisco streets, and that's why a bond was necessary. Now, why was that maintenance deferred? It was deferred because in the moment, there were other things that people felt were much more important. There were public health crises. There was the AIDS crisis. There was, you know, there were people who were being displaced during the first dot-com boom. There's always something that is immediate, that is crying for attention and that the public's extremely aware of and is lobbying very heavily to have addressed. And so the city takes money and moves it around. Now, as Joe knows, we have to have a balanced budget. That's a requirement. And so it is true that the budget in its current form isn't a balanced budget and is dependent upon that sales tax passing. If that sales tax doesn't pass, then money will have to be cut. Departments will be told to make reductions in expenditures. Some of the people who are supposed to be hired to do some of the work that's outlined in this budget won't be hired, and some of this work will get pushed further down the road. So the streets, I think, are a great example of that. That work kept getting pushed down the road until it was deferred maintenance that could no longer be ignored. Same thing with Muni. If we don't balance the budget, then some of the work that's outlined in this budget will get pushed down the road.
So I had a question there, though, about budgeting and how budgeting is done. Budgeting is often a forecast, right? A forecast on costs, but also a forecast on revenue. So is it so odd for San Francisco to be sort of banking on revenue, some of which actually hasn't actually been legalized yet? Is this common? Do you see this in other areas, or are we outliers here?
It's the information we have. It's what you have to do. And I would say that if you look at our credit rating, we have the second highest Moody's credit rating that one can have, and that says that we've done a pretty good job of managing our debt well, of making those forecasts reasonably accurately. Of course, they're never going to be exactly on point. We've been, the last couple of years, we've gotten a great deal more revenue and property tax than was anticipated because our real estate market just keeps going up into the stratosphere. So you do the best you can, and sometimes you guess high and sometimes you guess low, and if you're really, really fortunate, then those highs and lows balance out and you don't end up having to make a lot of cuts. But it doesn't always work that way.
I'm going to pause here for a moment to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio 91.7 KALW San Francisco and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight our guests are Joe Eskenazi, Senior Editor of Politics and Government for San Francisco Magazine and Editor of San Francisco Magazine's March 2016 feature, The City Report Card. And there we were just hearing from Lisa Feldstein. She's on the faculty at the Master of Public Affairs program for the University of San Francisco. If you have a question or comment for our guests, please dial 415-841-4134 to join this conversation. Again, that's 415-841-4134. What do you think of the way that San Francisco is spending its money? What do you think about budgeting at the ballot box? 415-841-4134. You could also email us at cityvisions@klw.com. Post a comment at the KLW website or tweet us at CityVisionsKALW. So I wanted to go back to something we've said multiple times so far this hour, which is that, you know, things are going well for us as a city. How does a city decide to spend its money, to budget its money at a time in boom times? So we know what happens in times when there's crisis, right? Services get cut and so on. But what's the formula? What should be the formula for how people think of budgeting during boom times? Do you spend it all now because you have it and you don't know how long it's going to last? How much do you set aside for a so-called rainy day? Joe, I wanted to start with you. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the city is being much more responsible now than it was in even the recent past. The city, as I noted earlier, gave itself pension holidays in the past. It did not fund the system, and that came back to hurt us at a bad time, because the funny thing about pensions is when things go south, suddenly you owe lots of money right when you don't have it, and that's a big problem. So the city was irresponsible there. The city allowed a unfunded health care liability to build up to the tune of billions of dollars that it's now finally addressing. That means more pay-in from the workforce, et cetera. They're doing pretty good about that. I think the city, if there truly is a downturn, it depends on how bad it is. And I don't think it will be something akin to the last dot-com bust, because this time the companies are much more fully realized. And they're real, and they aren't ridiculous ideas in quite the same way, though we could all have our fun about Twitter and whatever gibberish names are popping up on the sides of buildings. But I can tell you that if these companies were to go under, it would be a cataclysmic thing. It would be probably part and parcel of a global downturn. And if that's the case, then we've all got bigger problems. I think the city is doing a much better job looking ahead to fund what must be funded, which is, healthcare liabilities and pensions, which, the agreements state that those will be funded first. You are mandated. It's a contractual agreement. You've got to pay that. The city can go bankrupt, but you've got to pay those funds. And frankly, you should, because those people, came to work for you with the agreement that they would be paid. That was part of the agreement. So, again, I don't want to be all doom and gloom on the great amount that we're paying into our budget. I think that we are much more responsible now than we have been even in 5 or 10 or 10 or 12 years ago.
And part of that was because Tom Amiano brought Prop G before the voters in, I think it was 2003, that required that the city start saving for rainy days. And it's now the law that we do that, so that we do have some money set aside when things don't go as well as they were planned to go, or we hope that they'd go. So I think that that's been, that kind of enforced savings has been really a good control for us. It's so tempting to spend all that money when it's in front of you.
And how are we doing in terms of saving for rainy day? Are we meeting our targets?
Well, we're required to, and yeah, we are. But whether that's enough money or not, we won't know until the next downturn.
I got a shrug here from Joe. What did you mean by that, Joe?
Well, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but I can tell you that something that comes up again and again is with the city's investments, you're assuming a 7 or a 7.5% return. And if you don't make, that's what you need to make in order to break even. And that's hard to do, but we have managed to do it more years than not. There's some very talented people working for this city. Taken in a different context, that's a lot. That's a big return. And, if you are to downgrade your expectations, let's make 7% back instead of 7.5%, you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars that have to be put in from the city instead to make up for that. So the reservoirs can dry up pretty quickly. But again, there is a lot more structurally in place. Think of it like 1906. It would be a disaster today, but it probably would not be a disaster on the same scale, because we have the experience of the past, and we, God willing, should not repeat the mistakes of the past.
Hmm. So speaking of repeating or not repeating the mistakes of the past, it sounds like so much of our budget right now is making up for the mistakes of the past. Some of it is our progressive politics and our identity as a city. And the third area that's been mentioned is that there's a sense of people wanting to fund a certain level of quality of life for themselves as residents of a city. It seems like it's all cost here. So, right, paying back for the mistakes of the past, spending for those less fortunate, and wanting a high quality of life. So where's the revenue? Where's the revenue going to come from? We talked about this potential increase in the sales tax. Where else can the city look, or is the city looking, to increase its revenue? Lisa?
Well, one of the places that, in fact, probably one of the biggest places, is property taxes. And despite the fact that Prop 13 has really limited what the city can expect to receive in property taxes, we keep, since the most recent boom, we've been receiving more annually in property taxes than we anticipated and was planned for in the budget. And until housing prices come down, that's not going to change much. And even when housing prices do come down, there won't be a matching reduction in the amount of taxes. If new houses are sold for less money, then we'll see some reduction. But it won't be a huge drop in property taxes. But that's a really big budget resource for us. And then a lot of the money that we get from other levels of government, the state and the federal government, those funds that come in really are 50% of that $9.6 billion. We've been very successful at getting money from other levels of government, and I think there's no reason to think that we won't continue to be successful in doing so.
The assessor's office is something that people often overlook. We don't have corrupt assessors like we did in decades past, because after Prop 13, there isn't a need to reassess all the time, and so it's more automated. But people overlook the assessor's office. Lisa is exactly right. It's something akin to 40 or 45% of the general fund is coming in through the assessor's office. I think, again, another big driver in the future is going to be the airport. The airport's going to be bringing in a lot more money. It's becoming the West Coast hub to Asia. My understanding is the airport is moving to have more of those flights to Asia and is kind of phasing out the flights to Los Angeles. It's a lot more money coming in that way, and that money will go to the city.
So I want to reintroduce the program. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing San Francisco's budget. With our guests here in the studio, Joe Eskenazi, he's with San Francisco Magazine, senior editor of politics and government there, and Lisa Feldstein joining us by phone, faculty at the University of San Francisco in their public affairs program. And joining us also for the second half of our program, I'd like to welcome San Francisco Supervisor Mark Farrell. He represents District 2 and for the past 4 years has chaired the Board of Supervisors Budget and Finance Committee. Welcome, Supervisor Farrell.
Thanks for having me.
And of course, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. You can dial 415-841-4134 if you'd like to join this debate about how we spend our money and our value, and where we put money behind our values here in the city. 415-841-4134. You can also email or text us at cityvisions@kalw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So, Supervisor Farrell, what do you make of the budget that you and your colleagues received on June 1st from the mayor?
Well, you know, we're in the process right now at the Board of Supervisors of going through the budget. We employ a budget and legislative analyst that helps us review that during the month of June traditionally. So we've been having budget hearings in earnest, certainly for the last few months, but the true work of the budget started about a week and a half ago. And so we've been having hearings for the last week and a half, going through our budget. I will say from a high level, I do agree with the mayor's priorities in terms of homelessness, neighborhood quality of life, and keeping our economy strong here locally. Within that, obviously, the devils are in the details in terms of the budget itself, and, you know, we're at the point where we're dealing with line items here. So I'm a little bit in the weeds, if you will, but I certainly agree with the overall priorities. I think now we're looking to see exactly the budget that we can come to an agreement with both the mayor and the Board of Supervisors.
And so in these initial hearings, what kind of comments have come forth?
You know, we have a wide variety of comments. Today was actually public comment day at the Board of Supervisors for our budget. Today it lasted just about 4.5 hours long, which is a little bit shorter than in years past, but certainly not insignificant. A lot of people, and we thank them for coming to make their voices be heard. You know, we receive comments from people who are able to come to City Hall during the week. We receive comments on email. At this time of year, my email inbox is flooded with comments around our city budget. Certainly as the budget chair, I would expect that. And so, you know, we've heard a lot of support. Obviously, we've, in terms of departments that have gotten very political right now, obviously our police department is first and foremost within that list. But certainly, you know, more than anything during this time of year, we have advocacy groups coming to the Board of Supervisors who did not have all of their needs met in the mayor's budget, coming and asking for us, for their support, for our support, to put some additional funds in the budget to support the causes that they represent.
Were there any cuts this year?
This was, in theory, from the mayor's office, a no-cuts budget, if you will, for our different departments, which is certainly different in years past. Both last year and this year were the first 2 years in a long time where we didn't have the departments being forced to cut their budgets at the end of the day. Right now, though, part of our Board of Supervisors process is to entertain and accept certain cuts to the mayor's budget, working in conjunction with my budget committee, with our budget and legislative analysts. And then the question becomes, once we cut certain funds, what do we do with those funds, and how do we redeploy them? And that's really the policy work of the Board of Supervisors that we are going through right now.
And what kind of lines are you seeing drawn on the committee as it stands currently in terms of concerns or priorities?
You know, I think, as usual, there are a wide range of priorities. Everyone has certain things within their own districts that they want to take care of, whether it be fixing a broken swing, you know, adding water fountains, services to certain groups. That is obviously always something that is part of the budget process. But as in many years, we have a lot of citywide concerns that we want to see addressed in some form or fashion. You know, this year, certainly, youth services are a big deal. A lot of discussion around our LGBT community and what we can do to support them. I think certainly in the wake of Orlando, you know, that continues to be a high priority and something people are going to focus on. Food insecurity, public safety, in its own form and fashion here, some immigration and cultural things that are proposed to be funded. You know, we obviously passed paid family leave earlier this year, making sure we support that. And then a lot of homeless issues come about, and I think no one disagrees, and certainly personally as someone who spent a lot of time on the issue, no one disagrees that it's a topic that we need to tackle. Obviously, there's sometimes debate about how best to get there and what programs to fund or not to fund, but that will continue, in my opinion, to be a dominant topic during the budget process this year.
So I want to get to some calls here. Let's start with David from San Francisco. David, welcome to the program. Hello?
Thanks. Good to be here.
Great. Do you have a question?
Well, it's I guess more of a comment, and I'm live in Supervisor Farrell's district, so I appreciate that he's on the program. It's more of an observation. I've lived in New York City and other major cities, Seattle, and I guess I just have a general observation that I'm kind of shocked that San Francisco pays more per capita for services than.
I think we just lost. Did we just lose Dave? I think we did. Okay, so I think, yeah, Dave, if you'd like to call back, we'll go ahead and put you back on the air. But so the issue here of how do we lower the cost per capita is basically the question.
Well, if Supervisor Farrell's plan to get more Wi-Fi in the city was up and running, then that guy would have been had a better connection and we could have talked to him.
Thanks for that plug, by the way.
Yeah.
Are we getting Dave back on? Yeah, we have David back on. Okay, let's let David finish his question. Okay, David, sorry about that. Go ahead.
Sorry about that. Yeah, I did get cut off. It's really just a question about overall concerns about the cost overall we pay per capita than other major cities in the country, because I do not see, even in you know, in spite of the fact that we run an airport, we have Muni, we have a couple hospitals, I do not see the value that we're getting for the amount of money that we pay per capita. So I'm really interested to kind of try to get San Francisco more in balance with other major cities. So just, that's more of a comment than it is a question. But in particular, I'd like to hear Supervisor Farrell's comments about, in terms of budgeting, how he expects to kind of lower the overall cost per capita.
Supervisor Farrell?
Sure, and forgive me, I had a tough time hearing that question, but I think I got the gist of it about the cost per capita for our city budget, if you will.
And how do we get value for our money?
So two things to that comment, because it's a very fair question that we get a lot of the time. As the caller mentioned, we are the only place in San Francisco that is both a city and a county. So in San Francisco, we fund through our city budget many county functions. We do have an airport. We have a public utilities commission, sheriff's department, many things that are traditional county functions. And that equates to, you know, roughly half of our budget every single year. And so that needs to be taken into account. You know, in terms of other services and things that we pay for, you know, we are a defined city, if you will, 49 square miles. But everything, you know, when we think about the cost of housing, everything that we do as residents on our everyday lives and experience as residents, that it's very expensive to live here in San Francisco, that actually equates to our city government as well. And I'll give you a great example. In terms of our homeless population, one of the things that we've done for the past decade and a half is an idea called master leasing, where you know, at times we will build our own 100% affordable housing projects where we might house homeless individuals. Otherwise, we might rent out an entire former SRO building, for instance, and house individuals that way. Whereas in prior years, that might have cost $300, $350 a room every month. Now, the latest master lease contract we had was over $1,000 a room per month. And so the cost of government increases very much in parallel with the overall cost of living here in San Francisco. So it's, you know, we can get into specifics about it, you know, within every single department, but I think people, and it's challenging to translate this, but our overall cost of living as San Francisco residents is very much reflected in our overall cost of operating our city government as well.
So the city doesn't get a discount, so to speak.
Unfortunately, we don't.
I wanted to get responses from our other two guests. We haven't heard from you in a little while, Lisa Feldman.
Feldstein,
sorry.
It's all right. You know, I think that the supervisor is exactly correct. I would add to that we do things that in the short term may not look like they will save money, but in the long term potentially will. So, for example, when we limit selling sweetened beverages in public buildings, that in the short term doesn't look like it'll have any budget implications, except maybe a little less revenue in vending machines. But in the long term, it means our population is going to be healthier, which means the cost of public health is going to be cheaper in the city. So there are a lot of different ways to think about how we spend money, and there's we budget in the short term. Our budgets just look 2 years out. But impacts are much longer term than that, and it's much harder to quantify the further out you get how much something is going to be worth to the city or is going to cost the city.
Joe?
And I think that Supervisor Farrell's example is a good one to illustrate the notion of cascading costs through time. You know, take homelessness, for example. Once you get people off the street, they don't go to another dimension. You have to keep paying for those costs. So I think a common problem is to divide the amount that we spend on homeless and homeless services by the number of people that come up in the counts. And that's always going to be, you know, a huge mistake, because you're paying for a lot of people that you've helped, and you have to keep paying for them. And along the same line, you know, you have to keep paying for the employees that you had in the past because of pensions and health care, and that's as it should be. You know, we chose to be generous, and that's the decision we made, and it's very defensible. So, you know, those costs keep going up. And that means that things will, of course, cascade through time. You know, the hire that you made in 1980 is now a retiree, and you keep paying the cost of living, and that's how those costs go up. So that portion of it's going to keep going up. As far as the, you know, the caller's very prudent question about, you know, cost per capita, we don't have a lot of people. We don't have a lot of people, you know. The costs in San Francisco are very high, and we just aren't that big a city. So, you know, that's a good way to have high cost per capita.
And there's not much you can do there.
Well, I mean, more people will come, but you know, that won't lower the costs.
More people need more services.
That's exactly right.
But at some point, though, don't you get more a return on investment at some point? Because if you're going to build a certain amount of services, it can take care of a slightly larger population? Or do you really feel like it just keeps going and going and going? There's never a way to decrease cost per capita.
I don't think it's going to go up asymptotically, you know. But it's not going. It's not so simple as to lower cost per capita by bringing in lots of people. That brings in your own questions as far as affordability. You know, how much are these people making? How will they get around town? You know, who is going to direct traffic? All this. You know, who's going to build these roads that we keep talking about? That kind of thing.
So the question that came up again from our caller is value. And I know, Lisa, you said that it's really hard to kind of really project out what the value of decisions made today in a 2-year budget cycle or that they're going to be. But is there a way to start to ask that question more and more? Should we be asking that question more and more?
Well, I think there are ways that we can ask those questions and we can make decisions. But there are, you know, traditionally, Americans have used sort of the highest and best use valuation, and it's strictly a dollar valuation. And that's an easier way. It's still not perfect in terms of predictions and things, but that's a very simple way to try to get at some of those questions. But that ignores things like quality of life. Quality of life isn't really something you can quantify in dollars. And so if people are concerned about something like this, the condition of sidewalks, you know, they want the sidewalks cleaned more frequently, which is something that's reflected in this budget. Or they don't want people living on the sidewalks either because they find that it's disruptive to their lives or because they just think it's morally reprehensible for whatever reason. There, you can't put dollar values on those aspects. And so if you have a budget that reflects the city's values, it's really hard to then take those values and monetize them. Things cost a certain amount, but whether or not we're getting value for dollar is a really complex function. I mean, I don't know that there's a really clean way you can do it when you get beyond simple dollars and cents. What is value?
I would ask that to Supervisor Farrell as well. How do you think about this question of value?
And I think, you know, it was answered quite well. There's one actually really important aspect to add to this conversation, I think, that we haven't touched on yet, is that, you know, when you talk about the addition of the costs in terms of, you know, the per capita conversation, but it's an overall conversation about the city of San Francisco and our government. We are also very much having to respond to voter-approved mandates that have really come into play as we think about the costs that it takes for our government to whether it be to build housing or do other things. You know, a great example from the other year was the approval of an increased minimum wage, moving to $15 an hour, which was overwhelmingly approved by the voters of San Francisco. However, think about it from the city's perspective. We as well fund many, many nonprofits, and we need them to deliver the services that we rely upon or their San Francisco residents rely upon. Many of them are 100% city-funded or publicly funded entities. So when the voters approve minimum wage hikes, or, for instance, we just approved parental leave that was overwhelmingly approved, when we do those things and entities such as nonprofit organizations are 100% dependent upon public dollars to fund their operations, and we can have a separate debate about that. But when we do that, then they turn to the city of San Francisco and say, okay, well, we approved a higher minimum wage. It's going to cost my organization an additional 3% this year. We're looking to the city to fund that. And so, you know, the estimates are to build a unit of housing for the city of San Francisco is upwards of 30% higher than it is for private contractors here in the city of San Francisco who might not be subject to, for instance, prevailing wage laws and other things here in the city of San Francisco that represent the values that our voters have approved. I certainly believe of them very much so, but we have to be honest with ourselves that the cumulative effect of all of these mandates ends up in a higher cost of government.
Joe, did you want to respond there?
Well, I think that's a good thing to bring up, and I think that, you know, that is the cost of voting for higher wages, and it does trickle down. Something that I would love to see more of is, to the best of my knowledge, maybe Supervisor Farrell can correct me, but when I go through the voter guide each year, there's always going to be a controller's estimate of what this measure will cost the city. I don't think anyone ever goes back and reassesses those. Some of them have been horribly and spectacularly wrong. So I would love to see that methodology come in. And something that Supervisor Farrell brings up is that, you know, we do choose to fund set-aside. Supervisor Farrell put a set-aside for the Parks and Rec Department on this latest ballot, and the people overwhelmingly chose to fund it. Certainly, you know, there are arguments to be made either way, but the people were unambiguous in their choice, and now we will have to live with the budgeting consequences. And I like taking my kids to parks, and hopefully, you know, it'll work out well. Sorry, kid, just one kid.
And in the last few minutes of the program, I want to put the phone number out there if you'd like to join us here on Local Public Radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco here on City Visions as we talk budget with our guests Joe Eskenazi, Lisa Feldstein, and Supervisor Mark Farrell. Number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. You can email or text us at cityvisionsklw.org or tweet us at cityvisionsklw. Let's talk about a couple of areas. One is the decision to increase the number of police academy classes. This has raised some bit of differing opinions amongst the Board of Supervisors. And I wanted to hear from you, Supervisor Farrell, how will you navigate that conversation in the weeks ahead?
That's a great question. From the outset, I want to be clear that unequivocally, I believe public safety is one of the biggest issues that we need to provide as a city government, and one of the things that residents simply cannot do on their own and that we are responsible for. And so, you know, I believe keeping our residents safe is one of our, you know, top mandates inside of City Hall. And it's an issue that everyone is concerned about, both from a violent crime perspective, but also quality of life crimes, whether it be car break-ins or burglaries or so forth. I mean, this is the topic that I hear the most from my residents and people across the city of San Francisco right now. Obviously, there have been questions about our police department's actions over the past 6 months. You know, I've written op-eds and articles about this. You know, nobody condones racist text messages or other things like that, and so there's certainly behavior that needs to be corrected, and certainly we're looking at broader police reforms, which I think is the right debate to be having or certainly conversation to be having. But as it relates to staffing itself, you know, we have faced, when I came into office the 5 years prior, the Board of Supervisors didn't fund a single police academy class. And in the wake of record retirements, the combination put us at a staffing trough a few years ago that has been extremely difficult to get out of. And there is not a single supervisor that has not called our police chief over the past few years and asked for more cops in his or her own district. And so I think we need to separate out staffing levels and having enough officers from then kind of separately the officers' behavior, or kind of their actions or their training or some of the really hot topics that we're discussing right now. You know, obviously the city has, the voters of San Francisco, back again to this topic, passed in the early 1980s a charter amendment calling for 1,971 officers to be at full staffing. We have not been meeting that for years, and Mayor Lee put forth a multi-year budget proposal a few years ago, and that will culminate next summer in finally reaching that 1971 staffing level. However, I think it's important to note that that was based upon a population of about 650,000 people back in the early 1980s when now Senator Feinstein was the mayor. What the appropriate staffing level is today, I think, is a topic for much discussion. You know, there's been discussion around should it be based upon population or something else. Regardless, we are a larger city, we are a more populous city than back then, So I don't think that this discussion around police staffing levels is going to go away anytime soon, especially as we continue to see crime very prevalent on our streets.
Joe, did you want to respond there?
Yeah, I think that this is an interesting point here, is that, this $200 million gambit, as in we will withhold $200 million if you don't meet our chosen criteria on making advancements towards equitable policing, is one of the more dramatic elements of this budgeting season. And in the past, you had much more hard-knuckles budgeting seasons, and Supervisor Farrell was not on the board at the time, but if he has, and certainly he was politically active, he can chime in, and certainly the professor was probably involved in quite a few of these. But you don't have supervisors accusing the mayor of being a coke fiend, and you don't have the angry add-ons and putbacks and takeaways, and certainly I was a bit surprised that the lobbying from the nonprofits and others did not begin earlier. I was a bit surprised about that. There used to be, in years past, there used to be a stronger message put forward, as in we need X, Y, and Z, and there was then a contentious back and forth. That hasn't yet happened this year. I have my own theories. You know, I mean, I think in the end, Ed Lee wants to fund a lot of the things that that the supervisors want to fund, despite their other differences. It will be interesting to see what happens with the money that is being held over the police department. This is a surefire way to start a fight with the very contentious and protective union in the police officers union. And also it gets to the larger question of, well, deploying more police solve the problems that this city has with policing. That is an open question.
I want to try to get one more caller in. Let's go to Jackie in San Francisco. Jackie, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask, I'm not sure I heard it answered before, but I'm wondering what the return on investment is when the city and county invest in homelessness.
Tell us more about what's behind that question, Jackie.
What is the value of investing in homelessness? I mean, I personally am all for solving the problem. But when it goes into budget discussions, how can we possibly fight for it financially? I mean, what is the return on investment here?
I think I can answer that pretty.
When we invest in homelessness.
Thanks so much, Jackie. Go ahead.
I mean, it's a personal anecdote. I inadvertently failed in my own personal financial life to move several hundred dollars from one fund to another, and it was in a bond that had no investment return whatsoever. And then in 2008, the market crashed, so I didn't lose all this money. Instead, I made no money, but I didn't lose any money. So in the same way, when you help homeless people off the street and you help them into housing, you spend far, far less administering to them. And Supervisor Farrell commissioned a report with the budget with the controller or the budget and legislative analyst. You will correct me, but that says just as much. And we've been relying on other cities and other municipalities' reports that to say this, which is something that's kind of a common knowledge in city government, is that yes, it costs an awful lot of money to house people, but it costs even more money to administer to them when they're on the street, going to the emergency room all the time. You know, whenever someone has the DTs, you have a policeman and a fireman and a paramedic all showing up. If this person is housed and has access to services, it's a far more, not only is it a more humane thing to do, it's a more economical thing to do.
Well, and I want to add to that, Supervisor, that much of the homeless population is not who people think of. They think of the individuals who are adults, but a large proportion of our homeless population is families. And one of the best ways that we can both solve homelessness and reduce the cost is by breaking the cycle of homelessness. Children who grow up homeless are likely to be homeless adults for their lifetimes. And so if we can get those kids housed and into normal routines, going to the same school, not moving constantly, we will ultimately save a great deal of money and have a better assurance that those children will grow up to be productive members of our society.
And Supervisor Farrell, you get the last word. How can people stay in touch with the budgeting process and the hearing process at this point?
Well, certainly everyone is welcome to come. We are meeting again Wednesday at 10 a.m. To finalize our budget hearings, if you will. People are welcome to email us and call us at all times. The only thing I will add, we continue to have a very open and transparent budget process, which will, so long as I am budget chair, continue to be one of my biggest priorities. You know, in terms of homelessness, Joe was right, though. I did commission a report from our budget legislative analyst that showed that it's actually cheaper over time to house individuals than it is to leave them on our streets, which I think is really indicative of where we need to be going in terms of our housing policies and our homeless policies.
We're going to have to stop it there. Thanks for joining us, Joe Eskenazi, Lisa Feldstein, and San Francisco Supervisor Mark Farrell. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at klw.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show is produced by Wendy Holcomb. Join me next Monday as we discuss the challenges of being gay and Muslim. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.
This is 91.7 KALW San Francisco.